I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order and let the record reflect that the time is currently Wednesday, or the time is 1:39 p.m. and it's Wednesday, April 4th, 2018. And present today we have Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Foster. Just a reminder, folks could mute their cell phones. We also have Representative Ortiz. And this afternoon, we will have three bills, HB 398, Corporate Tax Public Utility Income Allocation, HB 129, Fish and Game Offenses, Licenses and Penalties, and HB 277, Broadband Internet Neutrality and Regulations. And we'll be taking public testimony today on these bills. So our first bill up today is HB 398, which is Corporate Tax Public Utility Income Allocation by House Finance. So at this time, I'd like to ask my aide, Brody Anderson, to come to the table and put yourself on the record and begin with your presentation.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Foster. HB 398 addresses foregone revenue and provides the state with the ability to capture new revenue in Alaska corporate income tax through the elimination of the public utility exemption for water's edge reporting. A brief history on how this piece of legislation was introduced. In 2014, legislation was passed that required both the Department of Revenue and Legislative Finance to create a report on indirect expenditures and the amount of foregone revenue not captured by the state. The first indirect expenditure report was submitted in 2015. The report identified a list of indirect expenditures within the Department of Revenue that should be terminated. Then last year, during the FY18 budget process, the House Finance Subcommittee for the Department of Revenue reviewed these indirect expenditures and recommended that the House Finance Committee offer legislation that eliminates the indirect expenditures. HB 398 repeals a specific exemption from the recommendations offered in both the indirect expenditure report and the subcommittee. The indirect expenditure repealed in 398 is the public utility exemption. It was selected for repeal for the following reason. The public utility exemption did not meet legislative intent, and it was felt that it provided a loophole by allowing multi-state corporations operating a public utility in Alaska to choose their apportionment method that was complementary to providing them the lowest tax liability possible. Typically, multi-state corporations use the three-factor formula for apportionment. This formula uses three fractions representing the ratios of the company's payroll, payroll, property, and sales within the taxing state to its total property, payroll, and sales within the United States. The three ratios are multiplied together to produce a percentage of the company's total taxable income to be allocated to the taxing state, in this case, Alaska. This only applies to all non-oil and gas corporations. For oil and gas corporations, we use a different formula. The Department of Revenue cannot indicate the amount of potential new revenue captured because of the small amount of taxpayers utilizing the exemption. They are required to keep that information confidential due to the size of the pool of participants. They have indicated, though, that there will be new revenue if this bill passes, according to their fiscal note provided with the members' packets. Mr. Co-Chair, I can walk through the committee through the sectional at this time.
Is it the will of the committee to go through the sectional? Please proceed, Mr. Anderson, on the sectional.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Section 1 of the bill amends 43 AS 4320 by adding a new section, 4320.146, by removing the exemption of the multi-state public utilities from the water's edge reporting within the multi-state compact. Section 2 is uncodified law, which adds a new section on applicability, Section 1 does not take effect under AS 4320, which is the Alaska Net Income Tax Act, until the effective date. Section 3 is also uncodified law by adding a new section, which is regulatory transition language, describing that they will not be implemented until after January 1, 2019. And Section 4 is the effective dates for Sections 1 and 2 becoming effective on January 1, 2019. Mr. Co-Chair, that is the sectional walkthrough and introduction of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. And just to note, we do have Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue, here and available to answer questions. Maybe, Mr. Spanos, if you could go ahead and come up to the table. Let's see here. I wonder, maybe Representative Wilson has a question. Did you have any introductory remarks, or are you available for questions, Mr. Spanos?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director for the Department of Revenue Tax Division. And no, I don't have any opening remarks. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So does this include nonprofits, our GVA, any of the electric utilities that we have?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, the nonprofits would not owe any tax under the corporate, the current corporate net income tax, so it wouldn't apply to them.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
So if I understand this correctly, so let's say there's a telephone company that's both here and in New York, and so what they would have to do is it would just basically be mathematical on how much they own here, revenue that they generate, and then a percentage would be split between us and New York as far as what taxes they have to pay?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, that's correct. When we get new corporate income tax staff, we'd like to explain it that the worldwide or the water's edge income is like a size of a pie. The more income you have, the bigger the pie. And how much property, payroll, and sales you have in Alaska determines how large of a slice you get out of that pie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions? Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could Brody, could you explain, you know, if I have a local utility in my community owned by the city. Would this bill have any impact on that kind of situation?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, a local utility owned by the municipality would also have tax-exempt status. So unless they had any, you know, any income from a non-tax-exempt reason, then no, they wouldn't. This wouldn't apply to them either.
Thank you. And I guess just trying to boil this bill down as much as possible, as I understand it, with regard to utilities that do business in multi-states, Alaska and some other states. Typically, you've got corporations should be following the three-factor apportionment income formula, so essentially a formula. And it looks to me like there are three utilities that are saying, no, we're not going to follow the formula that all the other corporations do, and they've come up with their own way of computing what their taxes. So essentially what we're saying is we would like to be consistent, and we want to take this exemption away so that everybody's following the same formula. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, that's fairly accurate. To clarify, the statute does allow them to choose a different method. It doesn't dictate how they need to, and that's really what this bill is doing, is saying here's the method you need to use.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions? Seeing none, I'm going to open this up for public testimony on HB 398. And folks can submit written testimony to the House Finance Committee by emailing us at housefinance@akleg.gov. And so with that, is there anybody in the room who would like to testify? I don't see anybody. Is there anybody online who would like to testify? I don't see any. So with that, public testimony on HB 398 is closed. And are there any questions before I set the amendment deadline? Seeing none, if folks do have amendments they would like to submit, please do so by giving those to Jane Pearson in my office by 5 p.m. on Friday, this Friday, April 6th, 2018.
Can we have an Eddie's real quick?
Sure, Eddie's. And House Finance is back on record. We have just moved the amendment deadline up to now. And so it sounds like the committee is comfortable with moving forward on this. So, Representative Seaton, I would entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe we have a single zero system now. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 398, version 330. LS1231/D from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there
a fiscal note?
And is there any objection?
Just quickly, not objection.
Representative Olson?
I just want to make sure, although it's a zero fiscal note, there is an indeterminate on the revenues that we may generate from it. So with that, I remove my objection.
Correct. And thank you for that point, Representative Olson. So if there are no objections, HB 398, version 30-LS1231/D for Delta with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note has passed out of House Finance. With that, we will sign the report. So, Eddies. Okay, next up today is HB 129, which is Fish and Game Offenses, Licenses, and Penalties by Rules by Request of the Governor. Online to present the bill is Major Bernard Chastain from the Department of Public Safety. Major Chastain, let me check. Are you online, Mr. Chastain? Let's take a brief at ease. House Finance back on record, 1:52 p.m. And Major Chastain, if you're online, if you could put yourself on the record and begin with your testimony on HB 129.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm here. Thank you. For the record, Major Bernard Chastain, I'm the Deputy Director of the Alaska Wildlife Troopers. I will be presenting House Bill 129 today for the committee. I apologize, first off, for not being there in person, and I hope to be able to go through this sectional fairly quickly for you and answer any questions. I also have on the phone and in the room several people that might be able to answer additional questions from the Department of Law, Department of Fish and Game, and potentially the court system. I don't know if there's someone available for that as well. Some of the questions you may have in committee today might be better addressed to them for some of the fiscal questions as well as some of the court questions. The bill in front of you today is the bill version 30-GH1687/J Juliet. Mr. Chair, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you just fine. Thank you.
Okay. I'll quickly go through the section and explain what this bill is. House Bill 129 will provide several things. First off, it will allow the Alaska Wildlife Troopers or citing authority to issue correctable citations for certain offenses. It will also prohibit persons from receiving sport fishing, hunting, and trapping licenses in Alaska if their privileges have been suspended or revoked in another state, in this or another state. It also increases the restitution amounts for animals harvested illegally, provides for an additional tool for Alaska Wildlife Troopers in charging wildlife, fisheries, and habitat crimes, by allowing some offenses to be reduced to violation offenses. And finally, it allows for display of licenses in electronic format to reflect modernization efforts made to the fish and game licensing program. Starting in Section 1 of the bill, Section 1, amend 1605.330A to include the word permit in addition to license and tag. And for purposes of clarifying the proper types of documentation a person must have in their actual possession when engaging in certain activities. It also reorders these activities of trapping and fur dealing and excludes the latter from being a correctable citation. The purpose for this will be explained in just a second. Under 1605.330, a person engaged in the activities listed in 1 through 5 of Section 1 must have in their actual possession a license, tag, or permit to legally engage in that activity. Section 1 reorders the activities in two separate categories. 1 and 2 are considered sport activities, while 3, 4, and 5 are considered commercial activities. Section 2, amend 1605.330D to make it unlawful for a person to obtain a sport fishing, hunting, or trapping license if the person's right to engage in those activities is revoked or suspended in Alaska. Surprisingly, in Section 2, you'll see the addition of the words this or another state. Even though we have the Wildlife Violators Compact, what Section 2 does is adds the words this or another state to this section, which includes the state of Alaska. Section 3, amend 1605.330 by adding three different subsections. In F, it provides that a person charged with failing to have the appropriate sport fishing, hunting, or trapping license in their actual possession may not be convicted if the person produces a license that was previously issued that was valid at the time of the offense no later than 30 days after the issuance of the citation. It also allows that a license or permit may be in actual possession in paper or electronic form. And the third section, subsection specifically states any peace officer presented with an electronic device under this section shall be immune from liability resulting from damage to the device. Section 3 covers quite a bit of territory there and talks about creating a correctable citation. This is in a situation where someone might forget their hunting or fishing or trapping license at home. The ability to create a correctable citation will allow, like with motor vehicle insurance, for someone to produce that license if they had one prior to the citation. Section 4 amends 1605.340 to require a person paying the reduced fee for a low-income resident hunting, trapping, and sport fishing license to provide proof of eligibility at the time of purchase. It is unclear at this time how the proof will be provided to the vendors that are issuing those licenses, and I should add that this was added in a previous committee. We're working through trying to figure out how this would work in actuality with vendors across the state of Alaska for this type of license. Section 5 increases specific penalties within this section, and it increases specific fines and penalties associated with unclassified misdemeanors and replaces it with Class A misdemeanors. This is the first of several sections, and I'm going to list these sections here. Section 5, Section 12, Section 21, Section 25, and Section 27. These sections were amended by a previous committee, and Department of Law can speak to some suggestions to the committee if they chose to do so, but I will walk through what this amendment or what these sections do. This amendment was designed to put a limit on the fines that could be ordered for some of these offenses in Title 16, which were being amended by House Bill 129. The amendment also removed the general reference to AS 1255 in many places and reinstated the specific incarceration penalties that are in current law. The amendment that was drafted, however, leaves references to Class A misdemeanors in areas where the specific penalties were reinstated. The language Class A misdemeanor has a specific meaning in the law, and the penalty for Class A misdemeanor is laid out in AS 1255. We recommend removing the reference to Class A and leaving those misdemeanors as non-classified misdemeanors. This is consistent with current law and other areas of the law in which a specific penalty is laid out in statute. The amendment 2 in the previous committee has been discussed with the amendment maker, and the representative is fine with this change. Section 6 of the bill creates two new subsections. It creates subsection C and establishes that a person may be charged with a violation offense if there's no culpable mental state established. And subsection D provides the court with the ability to impose additional restitution to the state of Alaska equal to the amount of lost federal matching funds such as Pittman-Robertson and Johnson-Wallet Barreau programs. Section 7 of this bill raises the strict liability commercial fishing violation fines from the amounts established in 1988 when this section was enacted to the same amount adjusted for inflation. The fine increase will serve both as a deterrent and a tool for the Alaska Walleye Troopers to effectively enforce the state's most important commercial fisheries. Section 8 requires the court system to transmit notice of all convictions under this section to the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. The Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission establishes points on commercial fishing permits, and it's important that they know when those convictions occur. Section 9 removes the penalty section from Section A and cleans up the subsection and makes it clearer as far as what the penalty is. Section 10 is related to Section 9 and it removes the unnecessary references and maintains additional penalties of additional fines for failing to salvage the hide in the skull of a brown bear. Many of these sections, Mr. Chair, clean up this section of law and establish Class A misdemeanors as the standard, but also establish that violation offenses may be charged. In many of these sections, you will see that there's a creation of a violation offense as well as a standardization of a misdemeanor offense. Sections 11 through 16 generally standardize penalties in the statutes listed by providing an additional option of charging a person with a violation offense when appropriate. Section 17 is a new subsection, and it's added to provide for charging offenses committed under 1605, 871 through 896 as a violation offense. Section 18 is titled Penalty for Violations, and it's amended to provide consistency in the penalties as provided in AS 1255 and provides for an exemption from new subsection under C. AS 1605-925B, in this subsection, it provides for restitution amounts that the court may impose for illegally taken big game animals in Alaska. This section increases the restitution amounts by at least 50% that a person convicted of unlawfully taking big game may have to pay if the court chooses to implement this restitution. Alaska's game belongs to the state of people in Alaska collectively, and when a big game animal is unlawfully taken, it defrauds the state of the value of that animal to its citizens. This value varies greatly depending on the species of animal, the location of the take, the social value of the animal, the economic value of the animal, and the food source value to the people of the state. These restitution values may be imposed by the court if the case warrants applying restitution. In most cases, it does not make the state whole for the loss of the animal, but helps pay the state back for the illegal take. Current restitution amounts were enacted in 1984 and have gone untouched since then. This section adds a provision that refers to inflation adjustment provision added in Section 19. In Section 19, you'll see that it states that a defendant may not be ordered to pay restitution to the state under this section if, as soon as reasonably practical, they voluntarily report taking to the department the game, and they surrender to the department all salvaged portions of the animal, including the horns, antlers, hide, and skull, if applicable. This subsection will provide an incentive for persons who have unlawfully taken big game animal and wish to turn themselves in. And this also protects hunters who want to do the right thing from paying additional restitution amounts. A new subsection in that section provides restitution amounts be adjusted for inflation every 5 years beginning in 2023. Section Section 20 has a new definition, and it defines electronic form as it pertains to display of licensed images on an electronic device. Section 21 is penalty for violations. This subsection is one of the subsections that was amended in previous committee and reflects the changes made in that committee. Section 22, titled penalties for violations. This subsection provides for a person without any culpable mental state would be guilty of a violation offense as provided in 1255. Section 23, titled penalties of violations. This section is amended to reflect that a person who violates 16.10.070 is guilty of a Class A misdemeanor as provided in AS 1255. Section 24, penalties for violation, establishes a violation offense in that same category. Sections 25, 26, 27, and 28 all establish violation offenses and standardized offenses within those statutes. Section 29 amends the uncodified law of Alaska and make it clear that the Act applies to offenses that occur on or after the effective date of the Act. And Section 30 states that the Act takes effect July 1st, 2018. Mr. Chair and members of House Finance, that completes the sectional of House Bill 129, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Major Chastain. We'll move into questions. I just want to note that we also have available to answer questions Aaron Peterson from the Department of Law, Trathlete Nancy Mead, Chief Counsel for the Alaska Court System, and Carol Petterberg, Bruce Dale, and Tom Brookover from Fish and Game. Do we have any questions? Representative Wilson and then Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So is the Department of Public Safety okay with all the changes that were made in the last committee, or are there some concerns about some of those changes?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, the Department of Public Safety is fine with some of the changes, but I think with some modification, the Department of Law could speak to about the penalties so they come in compliance with AS 1255. I think we can work through some of that. That may be better answered by Department of Law.
So if we could find out the same thing from the Department of Law, the concerns that they might have with the changes.
Sure. With Department of Law, we've got see here, Aaron Peterson. Are you in the, looks like you're in Anchorage. If you're there, if you could put yourself on the record.
Sure, this is Aaron Peterson with the Department of Law, Criminal Division. Mr. Chairman, so some of the changes that were made, they refer to Class A misdemeanors, and what the bill originally did was take the specific penalties that were non-classified misdemeanors in, for example, Section 5, 1605, 430, that used to have a fine of not more than $1,000 or by imprisonment for not more than 6 months or by both, and it changed that penalty to a standard Class A misdemeanor. And it did that, this bill, as originally proposed, would have done that on several non-classified misdemeanors throughout Title 16 to achieve uniformity with Title, charging under Title 12, the sentencing under Title 12, and of course the criminal code in Title 11. The change that was made now refers to Class A misdemeanors, but punishable by certain fine amounts and maximum incarceration periods that are not uniform with Class A misdemeanor under Title 12, which could potentially lead to some confusion, especially given the some of the case law or the new statutory language with respect to Class A misdemeanors, maximum sentences, while the maximum fine might be 1 year, in many cases 30 days is the maximum for your standard Class A misdemeanors under Title 12. So that could lead to some confusion. And I just got an email that it appears the department was under the impression that the changing that, that the amendment maker changing those back to non-classified misdemeanor penalties with the name Class A misdemeanors for moving Class A misdemeanor, that the maker of that amendment was in support of changing the language now to remove Class A misdemeanor. It appears that maybe that is not the case. I'm not involved in those discussions, but I just received an email that indicates that the maker of the amendment that made this change in the last committee would not support that any further modification. So I don't have that information, but that is what this email indicates.
I'm just really sorry I asked. I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we're really not equipped very much for this without having the background. So I would like to ask that, whether it's the Department of Law or whoever sends us a spreadsheet of what Class A penalties are in other sections of statute and what they're related to in these sections, so that we can figure out how we coordinate across the statutes the same penalties. because, on the phone, we've got a number of sections and all, and so I'm not sure. And I would like to also ask, Mr. Chairman, on Section 21, in the sectional analysis is where I'm looking. And it says that in that final sentence under the explanation, it says a person is guilty of a Class A misdemeanor and increases the associated specific penalty. So I'm not sure how you have the same action that is increasing a penalty. And I mean, if we have a specific penalty for this, is one thing, but if we have a specific penalty and we say the same charge is going to increase the specific penalty, I'm not sure how that works. So not being in judiciary where they work around these, I would like the department to send us in writing an explanation of how that corresponds, and if that is problematic, as I'm understanding the wording that is written here. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Peterson, is I guess, do you have any questions on that?
Mr. Chairman, I had my phone turned all the way up, and I could barely hear. I only got about one out of every three words.
Oh, no. Okay.
Okay. First of all, I was asking for a spreadsheet of Class A misdemeanor penalties in the other statutes and how that relates to the penalties in this statute, and so that we can compare and align those things. Any suggestions that you have would be helpful at that also. And then on Section 21, that in the sectional analysis that we were going through, it says in that bottom line of that is guilty of a Class A misdemeanor and increases the associated specific penalty. And so I'm trying to figure out if this is one action that has a specific penalty, but then that same action is be going to be classified as a Class A misdemeanor, and it increases above the associated specific penalty. And I don't understand how that works. I can understand how two different actions, one can increase a penalty, but I'm not sure as this reads in here. So if you could provide an explanation of that as well, I would appreciate it.
All right, so through the chair, again, this is Aaron Peterson, and I think some of that confusion is indicative of what I was describing earlier. Under 1255.035b1.5, a Class A misdemeanor is punishable by a fine of up to $25,000. That used to be $10,000 up until a couple of years ago. The omnibus crime bill raised that to $25,000. When this bill, the bill currently before the committee, was originally proposed, it changed all of these non-classified misdemeanors in Title 16 to, it removed the reference to specific penalties. So it took out the part in Section 21 about a fine of not less than $500 or more than not less than $100 or more than $500. And it replaced it with guilty of a Class A misdemeanor, punishable under 1255. So, again, the goal was to make it uniform with A misdemeanors throughout the criminal code. And so all your offenses in Title 11 refer to Title 11, the general criminal code, refer to sentencing in Title 12. So 25,000 is your standard Class A misdemeanor max fine. As I said, in the previous committee, it was changed. It added in a new maximum fine of $1,000, removing the standardization that would have been in place. So, and there are some places throughout the many statutes. I think, you know, in Title 41, for example, in forestry, there are some specific non-classified offenses that have their own penalties. And it's sort of rare. It's usually the older statutes that have those. And so, again, this bill was intended to originally was to make that uniform. Obviously, it would have been a great leap from $100 to $500 up to $25,000. But, again, the goal was to make them uniform. I would also note that, well, I'll leave it at that, and I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. And if you can provide that in writing and a spreadsheet so that we can see those categories, where they were and where they are now, and where other Class A misdemeanors, those ranges, then we'll be able to compare those more easily. So thank you.
Hey, do we have any further questions of the committee? Representative Tilton.
Thank you. Under Section 18, there's penalties for violation, and you spoke earlier about some of them were at least a 50% increase in the penalty violation. Was there any kind of a formula that it was used on determining the increases in the penalties outside of the 50%?
Through the Chair, Representative Tilton, this is Major Chastain again for the record. So Section 18 deals with specifically with restitution for big game animals. This is when restitution is applied, is when a person is convicted by a court and the court decides that the case warrants the additional money there that you see be applied to the take of that illegal big game animal. That in Section 18 was enacted in 1984 and had not been adjusted for inflation since then. So the original formula that was placed was $2,016 dollars, and this bill was placed put forward on in 2016, which adjusted those up and almost came to about 50% increase across the board. This bill has been in several committees along the way, and you'll see that some of those amounts are higher than 50%. Those reflect previous committee's belief that those animals are worth more than 50% higher than the restitution amounts that were originally in place.
Hey, do we have any Representative Tilton?
Thank you. I have another question that is just a kind of more of a curiosity thing on electronic form of display of the image of your licensing. This is just a curiosity thing. Would it, if the availability of the electronic licensing was there and you happen to have your electronic with you, would it be assumed that you should have that license on you?
Through the Chair, Representative Tilton, if I understand your question correctly, are you asking whether they have to have electronic version and the paper version at the same time?
No, I wasn't. Thank you for... But if you have your electronic device with you and there is the availability of having electronic licensure, would it be assumed that you should have that on your electronic device?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, thank you for the clarification. The answer is yes, that the there still would be a requirement that they have that with them on their electronic device. And I should clarify also that the electronic format of licensing is under development. What this would do is provide a statute which would allow for electronic licensing to be displayed, and at such time that the Department of Fish and Game has the ability to create a system where electronic licenses are displayed in a version or in a way that's easily enforced and will work for the public, that would be put into place. And we also have Department of Fish and Game online that could speak to electronic licensing if you'd like.
We've got a next question from or did you have another?
I have one last, but I'll wait.
Okay. Representative Wilson?
Yeah, thank you. Just on that point. So why couldn't I just take a picture of my license and count that as an electronic version?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that may be an acceptable format in the future for the department. One of the things that comes that is a problem with just taking a photograph of your license is many areas of the state have recording requirements on the back of your license, such as king salmon, steelhead, yellowwife, or other variety of fish, as well as hunting tags that have to be written, harvest ticket numbers have to be written on the back of your license. And so with recording requirements on the license itself, it presents problems if something has changed in the licensing to determine whether you've actually complied with the law.
Follow up. So what if I don't do all those things and I just salmon fish, I don't have to record anything on there? You're telling me even if this bill passes, that wouldn't be good enough until regulations are written?
Fix the ticket.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, again, licensing is developed by Department of Fish and Game. So whatever format they say is acceptable will be acceptable to enforcement. However, if you're only fishing and there's no recording requirements and the Department of Fish and Game specifies through statutory authority that a photograph of the license is acceptable, that will be fine for enforcement.
So I guess we just have to wait for regulation. Thank you.
Representative Tilton.
Thank you. I just have one final question. Is the effective and applicability date of this is July 1st, 2018, which is not that far away for such a large change in the bills, that some amounts that haven't been changed since 1984. Just wondering about the effective date.
Was that for Major Chastain? I don't know if you.
Yes, Mr. Chair, through the chair, Representative Tilton, the effective date is simply the July 1st time frame to get these implemented. There are some portions of the bill that would be very easy to implement. They're just law changes and penalty changes. And for the most part, all these could be implemented by July 1st, with the exception of two pieces. One is Section 4, which requires that a person provide proof of eligibility for a Class 5A license, which I think Department of Fish and Game needs to speak to that portion. And then the second would be the electronic licensing, the idea being that this bill would provide a legal mechanism for electronic licenses to be available once the Department of Fish and Game develops those.
Thank you. I've got a question from Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize to everybody that I was gone for a bill hearing. I appreciate the bill. It's something I've wanted to do for many years, and frankly that I was going to insert into as a barnacle onto somebody else's bill, but I didn't realize this was here. I do have two concerns, only because I'm rushing through this. I also believe that subsistence permits, are subsistence permits addressed by this legislation? It's my understanding is that if you forget your permit at home can also be a crime if you don't have the permit on you.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, subsistence permits are not part of the – there's two portions here, I guess, that we have to address. First is subsistence permit is not a sport fishing, hunting, or trapping license. That would be the correctable offense. Simply those three things would be correctable. So, with permits, subsistence permits have recording requirements on them. So as you take fish, you're required to record the take on those permits. And if you forget the permit at home, you have no way to record that on the permit before leaving the fishing site.
Through the chair.
Representative Gere.
I'm going to chomp on that, but a mistake is a mistake, and I don't like making something that's an honest mistake a crime. So let's leave that one to the side. I understand your point that it has the additional recording requirement. The other problem I have with this bill is, as I recall from long, long, long ago when I practiced a little bit of criminal law, certainly a crime goes on your record, and we don't want this to be a crime, and I appreciate that part of the bill. But also a violation, I believe, goes on your record, whereas a fine does not. And so would you have any objection to making these violations fines? I mean, to me, it's just an honest mistake that you forgot your permit at home. And if you correct it, it's like a fix-it ticket, but a violation, as I understand it, does not look great on your record. It looks like you did something wrong as opposed to forgot something at home.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I'll answer the first part of that, and I'll let Department of Law Aaron Peterson answer the portion about penalties for violations, but I'll start. So violation offenses and fishing game law are recorded as violations. They're considered like a speeding ticket, even though so currently law enforcement has the ability to see whether you have received a speeding ticket or not in whatever jurisdiction you're in. We also have the ability to see whether you received a citation for not having your sport fish license or failing to record fish on a subsistence permit. There's a variety of things that can be seen, and that does show up also in court view, just like a speeding ticket does. Violations are separate than misdemeanor offenses. They have less penalties associated with them. So, I guess to answer your question, it would be a policy call whether the committee or the legislature chose to change the category of offense from a violation to a fine. However, this is still a criminal offense. And I'll let Aaron Peterson speak to that if he has anything to say.
Mr. Peterson?
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Aaron Peterson, Department of Law. Through the chair, Representative Garrett. Yeah, it has been described, these type of offenses, fishing offenses that are minor offenses, have been described by Alaskan courts as quasi-criminal offenses, everything basically ranging from quasi-criminal offenses to non-criminal violations. The violation, the term, essentially means, in the language of criminal law, something that's only punishable by a fine, because by definition, under 1255.035, a violation is punishable by up to a $500 fine unless the statute has a specific fine associated with it that is different. And under 1255.135, sentences of imprisonment, there is no term of imprisonment for a violation. So someone cannot be imprisoned for a violation. So what you're describing, you know, calling something a fine, there's certainly a linguistic difference, but the outcome is the same. Violations are only punishable by a fine. I would also note that, strict liability violations, part of what this bill does is it creates that second level, that lower level of offense for many of the offenses currently in Title 16 that are only punishable as a misdemeanor, in many cases a non-classified misdemeanor. It adds the lower level offense of a violation so they don't get a criminal conviction for a misdemeanor. Rather, they get what Major Chastain pointed out, a minor offense that is equivalent to a traffic infraction.
So that's what I had recalled. So violation is sort of considered quasi-criminal. It's just not quasi-criminal in my mind to forget your license at home. It's a mistake. So you used a term infraction. I'm trying to think of the things that are lower than a violation that we could call this so that somebody doesn't have something on their record that causes somebody to raise their eyebrow when they just made a mistake. Is infraction the term? Is fine the term?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I don't know what term would be used in the parlance of criminal law. I'm not familiar with any term that would, come before the court other than violation, which, as I said, only – I understand, there's potentially a connotation for a quasi-criminal offense that somebody could view that as, because the word criminal is there, a criminal offense, but in reality, nobody would really think that of, a speeding ticket or something like that, and that would be a more accurate equivalent. Also, there's a potential for fix-it tickets, and I think, that's something that could be addressed that isn't currently possible, so that could potentially assuage your concern there.
Chair.
Representative Gere?
The fix-it ticket thing is much more appealing to me. I don't know whether Ms. Mead might have some ideas, but I guess what did you mean by a fix-it ticket as an alternative? It just disappears once you present proof that you had the license?
Mr. Chair, I was going to throw it to Major Chastain.
Mr. Chair, this is Major Chastain for the record. Through the chair, Representative Guerra. The fix-a-ticket idea is simply that if someone forgets their hunting license or fishing license or their trapping license at home, that they have the ability to present that within 30 days, and it will become a non-event. Basically, it's not on their record. There's no fine associated with it. It's just like motor vehicle insurance, proof of insurance to a law enforcement officer that they had a license before the time that they were contacted. You had questions about subsistence permits and forgetting other things at home. While I understand what you're asking, there's requirements under regulation, which Fish and Game could speak to, Sport Fish Division, for instance, that would talk that the Board of Fish has enacted for recording requirements and other things that are needed in order for those things to be on your person and fish to be recorded. Those vary amongst the different types of permits that Fish and Game hands out. For instance, personal use permits, we have 30 to 50,000 people a year that participate in dip netting across the state of Alaska, some of them forget their permits. Their requirement is that they have their permit on their person, that they record the fish prior to leaving the fishing site, and that they mark their fish in accordance with the regulations in the Board of Fish. There's varying degrees of requirements, and the only reason that wildlife troopers enforce it that way is because it's in place in statute or regulation.
We don't either.
Thank you, Mr. Chastain. Representative Guerra?
Thank you, through the chair. For some reason, I don't have page 2 in my packet, Section 3... says that the Section 3 provide that for all of these licenses that you may have forgotten at home, if you show it within 30 days, then it just disappears from your record?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, Section 3 provides a mechanism for the Alaska Wildlife Troopers to make it a correctable citation for not having a sport fishing, hunting, or trapping license in your actual possession at the time, and it goes away. It's not in your record. It is not a citation that they have to pay. It becomes a officially correctable citation. We, the Alaska Wildlife Troopers, have been operating under this quasi I'll just be very honest with you, a quasi-legal mechanism where we've been unofficially allowing correctable citations over the years. And Department of Law has advised us that is not a a legal way to do it. So all we're seeking here is a legal mechanism to make correctable citations for certain offenses.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. And then what I don't understand, though, the 30 days I've got a problem with, I mean, just in case somebody is not able to do it within 30 days, but the question I have, I guess, is we've got the all of these, so sport fishing, hunting, trapping license, you leave it home. Section 3 says if you prove that you had one purchased at the time, you just show it, and therefore the charge disappears. Then what are the things that are a violation then? What if you don't show it within 30 days?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra. So I'll start with the 30 days. The 30-day is the standard right now for correctable citations with other correctable citations. So motor vehicle insurance as an example. That is the standard a person has to, 30 days to present it. If they do not present it within 30 days, that citation goes through the court system, and it is not eligible to be corrected. It's not eligible to be signed off. There's other examples of correctable citations like window tint or studded tires. Those are all correctable citations within 30 days. And if someone fails to present the corrected piece by then, the citation goes through the court system, and it's not eligible to be corrected.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
I'm sorry. So is my understanding correct then, if you under the bill as written, if you show it within 30 days, it disappears from your record, and if you fail to show it within 30 days, then it's a violation, or is something else a violation under this statute, under this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, if you fail to show the license that you had previously purchased within 30 days, it is a violation offense, and that there is an established bail schedule for not having that license in actual possession, and it's considered a violation offense for someone who does not present it within 30 days.
Through the chair, I'm just going to, I've been out in the wilderness for more than 30 days. I know people who go to fish camp sometimes are there for a long period of time, and by the time they get back to town, might not live in a community that has a courthouse. So the 30 days, I appreciate Section 3. That's exactly what I've been looking for, except it doesn't address the subsistence problem. I guess I would like to, at some point, address the 30-day issue because I don't think, you know, I mean, what if it's 90 days and then in 90 days you show that you had a license at the time you were picked up by the police or the trooper? You had the license. You purchased it. What does it matter whether it was 90 days or 30 days that you bring it over to the courthouse? You're punishing people for being late at this point. So, I'd like to see a different number there, and I can let other members address whether subsistence should be addressed in here. I understand it's a different issue with the permit that has to be filled out.
Hey, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. On that issue as well, if I may. So what does it look like if you didn't have your license, they gave you a citation, and you didn't show it or prove that you had it within 30 days? I mean, the department has a copy of it, but you have to produce it. What does it show? What does it look like on your record?
To the chair, Representative Guttenberg. So if the citation goes through, it's a violation offense. There's in what's called APSIN, which is the records that we use for police officers across a variety of different law enforcement databases. It shows up in the non-criminal section, which is the fish and game offenses, as a violation offense. So when you come in to the Alaska Department of Public Safety and you get an interested person's report and you ask for your history or your criminal record, you're asking for your criminal record, which would show things like DUI or driving without a license or other serious crimes. The fish and game offenses section is separate than the criminal offenses section, and it would show up as a violation offense. It would tell just like it would in court view, which the court system might be able to answer this question better, but it would show in court view that you were convicted for a violation offense, the fine of $200, and that the whatever other information that court has to be included in that.
So if I can follow up.
Follow up?
Right. So you mentioned dipnetting, and this is something that exactly happened to me. Came off of Chitna, went into the Fish and Game office to all the tails had been properly clipped. We were going in with our the cards that, you know, the card counting the number of fish we got. There was a Fish and Game trooper there. One of us didn't have his wallet with him, right? It was 5 minutes away. There was a push to give him a citation. So theoretically, what happens if he had given him a citation, written him a ticket, and 5 minutes later he came back with his license? Would that trooper have been allowed to negate that ticket?
Through the chair, Representative Gutenberg. Currently in law, there is no mechanism to allow us to make a correctable citation. This bill will allow us a official way to make a correctable citation for a few offenses, not carrying your sport fishing, hunting, or trapping license in your possession. In the scenario that you presented with dip netting, there are requirements established by the Alaska Board of Fish, which require that you have your permit in possession for dip netting. It requires that you record your fish immediately before leaving the fishing site on your permit, and it requires that you actually cut the tails off your fish before leaving the fishing site as well. In the scenario that you presented that stuff, if the trooper was told that it's 5 minutes away and I'll be right back, I would hope the trooper would use common sense and not issue a citation for that offense.
I would hope so also. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions of the committee? We do have Fish and Game on the line, Natalie Weber and Bruce Dale, throughout this discussion. I don't know if you had anything that you wanted to say, if you are online, and if you did, please just put yourself on the record. And it sounds like nothing. So with that, let's move over to public testimony on HB 129 is now open. And if folks would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by emailing us at housefinance@akleg.gov. Again, housefinance@akleg.gov. Is there anybody in the room here who would like to testify? Please go ahead and come up to the table and put yourself on the record, just your name and if you have any affiliations, and proceed with your testimony.
I thought I'd seen a couple names ahead of me. I didn't think I'd be first. My name is Martin Stepton. I'm from Juneau. I live at 3333 Noel Avenue. And I just wanted to testify on this bill only after listening to you guys talk about it, because as a person who has gotten away with I got pulled over a couple times without having my insurance card, because my wife gets the insurance every 6 months, but I don't always remember to put it in the car. So that happened to me twice, and I've been saved. I got pulled over by the state troopers one time, and I got pulled over by the Juneau Police Department. And both times I was saved by such a law that protected me. I was able to go in and show my insurance card, and I was able to, you know, not get a violation, which is great, because that happened two times in the past, and now I'm trying to join the National Guard right now. And so if those laws hadn't been in place, it would have been really hard for me to try to get into the National Guard, even with such a small violation. Trust me, they don't take anything small. They almost won't let you in with such a violation. So these kind of laws do protect people, especially people trying to join the National Guard. So that's all I wanted to say. The fix-it ticket rule would work out really well, maybe even extending it from 30 days to 90 days, as Representative Gara was suggesting. That's all I wanted to say on that.
Thank you for your testimony. And that was Mr. Stepton?
Yes.
And do we have any questions? Seeing none, thanks for coming in. I don't have anybody on the list online here. Is there anybody else in the room or online? No? Okay. Okay. And so with that, we will close public testimony on HB 129. And is there any other questions? Yeah, Representative Kawasaki?
Thank you. And I don't know who can answer this, just anybody. Now that I have a page two, I have a section four. And I just have a question how that so there's a $5 fee applied to folks who's folks who live in are in poverty, and there's some poverty guidelines language in on page two in section four. And then in section five, it changes the shall provide proof of eligibility before purchasing a license. Can you get a license like this at like a Fred Meyer? Or can you only apply in person at a fish and game office?
And if there's anybody at fish and game or anybody who would like to take a stab at that, go ahead and chime in.
I got to unmute me.
You are.
Mr. Chair, can you hear me? This is Bruce Dale.
Yes, Bruce Dale, if you could just state who you're with, and we can restate the question if you need to.
Yeah, this is Bruce Dale with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Yes, you can purchase this on any license. You basically just sign an affidavit on the back, check the box that you're eligible for the $5 license, and sign it, and that's the proof that that you are indeed eligible, and allows the troopers or whomever to prove up on it if there's some question.
So the
question that we have is what is that? Is that sufficient, or is this going to require some piece of evidence of this? Just for background, this was put in the previous committee because they thought there was abuse of the system. We actually did some research, and we found that the proportion of the $5 license is about the same as the proportion of the general public that's receiving some assistance. And so we had stated before, and now we have some evidence that we don't think that there is widespread abuse of this.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Dale. I guess my question was just a practical one. So when a person comes to Fred Meyer and wants to buy a $5 license, it used to say that they must provide proof of eligibility when requested by the license, by the department, I guess it is, and by extension, Fred Meyer is able to sell licenses, I guess, on your behalf. So now it says that they shall provide eligibility when purchasing the license. And I just have a question about, is Fred Meyer going to suddenly have to have some sort of, some proof of eligibility that a person is eligible for the cheaper license?
Through the chair, this is Bruce Dale with the Department of Fish and Game. That is a question we have from the amendment that was adopted. Is this going to require some other form of proof of eligibility, and what should that look like? This may be difficult for some people in rural areas to obtain the proper proper paperwork, and it's not clear from the amendment what that paperwork would look like.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any further questions of the committee? And I'm not seeing any, so we're going to set the bill aside. If folks have amendments, if they could just get them to my office by 5 p.m. this Friday, April 6th, to Jane Pearson. So let's move to the last bill of the day, and that is HB 277, which is Broadband Internet Neutrality and Regulations by Representative Kawasaki. And Sir Representative Kawasaki, if you and your aide, Jacob Garish, could come to the table and put yourselves on the record. And just a reminder, since we have two male voices, if you could just identify yourselves prior to speaking. And so with that, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, Representative Scott Kawasaki, House District 1.
And Jacob Garish, staff to Representative Scott Kawasaki.
I appreciate the members and the chairman hearing the bill today. I just wanted to say before just starting that if you think about it, everybody's got one of these phones in their pockets probably right now, even though they shouldn't be. And these are only 10 years old. Technology has changed vastly in the last decade. I remember my first personal computer as a kid and how much more advanced this is today. So a lot of things have changed when it comes to technology, and a lot of things have also changed when it comes to the Internet. Since 1996, we've been under rulings that are similar to what is called net neutrality. My staff will discuss a little bit more about about net neutrality and how that's been implemented over the decades. House Bill 277 would require internet service providers within the state of Alaska who provide the broadband internet to Alaskan families that they engage in the practice of net neutrality and continue to do so. The bill would make sure that all data on the internet is treated equally, and it would protect small businesses from uncompetitive practices and guarantee an open and free internet for all users. Without net neutrality, internet service providers can legally speed up certain sites, slow down certain sites, block sites altogether, or require certain users to pay more for internet fast lanes. The elimination of net neutrality gives internet service providers the power to determine what website consumers could visit and what content creators could share. Allowing internet service providers to discriminate based solely on content undermines a free and open internet. Eliminating net neutrality would risk First Amendment rights for our Alaskans, the free press, free association, and the right to privacy. On multiple occasions, millions of Americans have publicly commented in favor of protecting these net neutrality laws and spoken out recently against the FCC commission order to eliminate net neutrality. Those rules were set in place by official action in 2015. The internet's a modern necessity here in the state, and especially in a state that's so vast and requires things like telemedicine, telehealth, communications, and so anywhere out of any other state, really net neutrality is a necessity for Alaskans. And I just wanted to say that this is, again, it is supported by millions of folks across the United States. It's sort of it is the law of the land in places like Europe. I just wanted to mention that in addition to the millions of folks who do support net neutrality, it's a fairly bipartisan issue. Respondents across the political spectrum believe that the internet and net neutrality ought to be protected, 78% total. A large majority of Democrats, 88%. A large majority of independent voters, 71%, and even a large percentage of Republicans, 67%, are in agreement. There's also groups like the AARP, the Gun Owners of America, conservative groups like the Christian Coalition, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, the United Church of Christ, groups that are perceived as little left-leaning like MoveOn.org, ACLU, the Writers Guild of the American West, are also in support of net neutrality for the basic reasons of an open and free internet. And with that, I will defer to my staff for technical questions.
Great. And Mr. Gersh, were you going to go through the sectional analysis?
Yeah, if that's the will of the committee, I'd be happy to.
It looks pretty short. Representative Wilson?
I'm sorry, before you do that, I still have no idea what you're talking about.
So. He's going
you keep saying net neutrality, but I don't. What's the definition of that? And are you talking about just the speed of the internet? You know,
thank you, Madam Chair. And there's a couple different examples that I think my staff would like to share on it. But think of the internet as an information highway. You've heard of that before. What the provisions of net neutrality are is that everybody has equal access to drive on this highway. They can drive. They can all drive 50 miles an hour. They're not regulated based on the kind of car you have. They're not regulated by the person who owns the road because they're common carriers. And so net neutrality is sort of the essential idea that everybody has the same access as everybody else. So whether you're a large corporation that wants to advertise to consumers in downtown Juneau or you're a person who who sells things on Etsy, you get to have the same speed and the same rates and the same accessibility that everybody else does.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
So my children who like a game all the time and are willing to pay a lot of money, in my opinion, for the speed so that they can do that versus someone who just does documents and those types of things. Is that what you're talking about, that both those types of Internet accessibility would be the same amount of money?
This is Jacob Garish, through the chair to Representative Wilson. It's that, and it's even more in-depth. So it could even be if there's a specific video game company that is owned by the broadband company, they could prioritize the Internet for that specific video game over other video games. So it's that, and it's much more. It's about specific sites, and it's not just about different types of services.
I'm a little closer. Thank you.
Mr. Garish?
Pizza.
Okay, Mr. Garish, did you have any more? Were you going to go through the sectional analysis?
Yeah, I'd be happy to go through the sectional. Section 1 adds a new Internet neutrality section to AS 4205, the Alaska Public Utilities Regulatory Act, that requires Internet service providers to disclose network management practices, performance, and commercial terms so that consumers can make informed decisions, as well as to not block, impair, prioritize, or interfere with Internet access, website content, or Internet traffic. That section also provides for an exemption to the restriction on prioritizing if the Regulatory Commission of Alaska finds that such an action would benefit the public interest. Section 2 changes AS 4550471, adding violation of Internet neutrality to the list of unlawful acts and practices in the Alaska Unfair Trade Practices and Consumer Protection Act. And the final section is applicability section for contracts entered after the effective date of the bill. So HB 277 would not apply to contracts entered between ISPs and customers before that date.
Thank you, Mr. Garish. Also available for questions, Jonathan Clements from the Department of Law, David Parrish and Kristen Schubert from the RCA, and the at the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. We've got a question from Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I'm just trying to make sure that I have the understanding of this right. So you as a consumer, or me as a consumer, I have the right to go buy a certain speed of Internet supply. And so that isn't being affected by this. What's being affected is if I buy a 10 megabyte speed, that all of the content that is provided to me will be at the same speed. In other words, it won't be throttled down for some consumer site, some consumers, I guess it'd be a site, not the consumer site, but a product site or a game site or a movie from one distributor, and would be the full 10 megabyte speed if I get that movie from your preferential site. So that's what this prevents, is you as the provider of the Internet access to me that I'm paying for won't change those dimensions of the products that I can receive. I'll receive all my products without disruption, built-in disruption, by the provider that I'm getting 10 megabytes from. Is that generally correct? I'm sure I'm not right on all the specifics, but.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I think you're very close to describing it correctly. An example that I like to think of is the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, where if you're an oil producer on the North Slope, you can get access to the pipeline and you're allowed to send the product through the pipe down to Valdez, and everyone else has the same access, so that a smaller exploration firm can have that same access. And in that way, it encourages that smaller company to enter the market and perhaps become a larger company.
Just for the record, that was Mr. Garish, Representative Seaton.
So, in other words, of course, it's not physically possible in the TAPS pipeline, but as a producer, you put it in the pipe and it all travels at the same speed down to Valdez instead of the Alyeska being able to say, well, we're putting you on a slow path, and so yours is going to take twice as long to get to Valdez because you're not our preferred supplier. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yes, this is Jacob Garish. That's exactly right, Co-Chair Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Do we have any further questions? Seeing none, let's go over to public testimony. We have a number of folks who would like to testify on this. So that is open on HB 277. And if folks would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by emailing us at housefinance@akleg.gov. And so with that, I'll take these in order in which folks had signed up here. So Mike Robinson, calling in from Anchorage, if you could state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your two-minute testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Robinson, and I am with the Alaska Library Association. And I'm here today to speak in support of the HB 227. I'm going to kind of skip through some of my comments because I think the presentation covered a lot of what we're interested in. But the question is, why do libraries support net neutrality? And it's for two reasons: equitable access and intellectual freedom. Libraries often serve as the gateway to the internet for people in their communities, sometimes the only gateway. Equitable access is about reducing the digital divide in Alaska by allowing full participation in the online world. In addition to serving as internet portals, libraries provide access to online subscription content and services such as e-books, newspapers, and academic journals. The ability of broadband companies to create internet fast lanes for content providers who are willing and able to pay a premium undermines this principle of equitable access. Some people argue against net neutrality, believing market competition will be sufficient to ensure equitable access. But we know that in many communities in Alaska, there is no market competition when it comes to broadband. Perhaps more importantly, libraries support net neutrality for intellectual freedom reasons. Libraries support the freedom to read and access all legal speech, regardless of type or origin. Broadband companies should not be in the position of making decisions about what content to promote or hinder access to. The Internet now plays a crucial role in our democracy, and it's important that broadband companies remain neutral gateways and not become gatekeepers. I thank you guys for this opportunity.
And thank you, Mr. Robinson. Does the committee have any questions? I don't see any questions. So thank you for calling in. Next, we will move over to Mary Jo Torgerson, also calling from Anchorage. If you could put your name and your affiliation on the record.
Hi, my name is Mary Jo Torgerson. I'm the director of the Anchorage Public Library, and I am in support of HB 277. You know, libraries are in the business of providing free and open access in a neutral way. Net neutrality, when it was in place, allowed for that. I'm concerned that without this provision, utilities will get to make up their own minds, and even though a utility might say, oh no, we're going to protect net neutrality, I think that it's kind of in the best hands. I appreciate that you're being so proactive. You know, internet is really one of the primary mechanisms for delivering information, both in-home and as well as for the library. And it's especially important that commercial ISP or internet service providers are not able to control or manipulate the content of these communications. Libraries are about people being able to make their own choices, provided with a vast array of information. The net neutrality protected that. However, with the recent FCC ruling, you could provide, if a company is willing to pay the price, they could go a lot faster and push out perhaps smaller ISPs. So libraries are about freedom of access, and So I support this HB 277. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Torgensen. We've got a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So since this has changed, have you seen a difference in the Internet there at the library?
Well, you know, at this point in time, I think it comes up in April. And at this point, no, but I think you had asked some questions earlier about what does it mean. So think of a grocery store and a grocery store providing end caps for a greater price to sell Lucky Charms, for example. Maybe you're a small vendor and you can't afford a Lucky Charm shelf space, and that would be the same for information. So no, I have not seen it yet. I have not seen the impact. I vaguely remember GCI indicated that they would protect net neutrality. It shouldn't be up to the provider for protection of that. It should be up to the government.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Any further questions? I don't see any. Thank you for calling in. Next up, we have Evelyn Trifon calling from New Haven. Evelyn, if you could put yourself on the record, your affiliation, and proceed with your two-minute testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Evelyn Trifon. I live in New Haven, Alaska, which is located off Lake Eliana. I'm calling in support of net neutrality. It is of the utmost importance for Alaska, and especially rural Alaska. I currently have a plan with GCI, and I'm very thankful that GCI has taken a stance to keep net neutrality in place. But if they ever did, if they were sold, or if they ever just simply changed their mind and eliminated the net neutrality, I have no idea what would happen with my home internet. I currently pay $220 a month, roughly, for only 60 gigabytes of home internet. I feel this is too high to pay for internet, but I have no other choice if I want high-speed internet in my house. I believe the internet should be accessible to all Alaskans at a reasonable rate, speed, and price, so that's why I'm calling today to express my support of net neutrality.
Hey, thank you, Ms. Trifon. Are there any questions from the committee? And I don't see any, and so... let's move over to here in the room, and then one more person on the lines. Martin Septon, if you could also put yourself on the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Kawasaki. I appreciate this bill. I prepared a statement. Net neutrality represents the forefront of the First Amendment and freedom of speech. Net neutrality will protect the citizens of Alaska from legal spats between large companies such as GCI and its parent company, Liberty Interactive, a very large corporation not from Alaska, and other Alaska corporations whose customers need such protection. Net neutrality has been watered down at the federal level recently, adding pressure to states to create their own laws to protect their own citizens. I have wrote both Senator Lisa Murkowski and Senator Sullivan before Congress repealed the FCC's strong net neutrality laws last year. They both had their reasons for voting to repeal these laws. Bottom line, we are not protected under any form of net neutrality laws by the federal government, and therefore we must act to protect our own state. Broadband in Alaska is growing to the farthest reaches of our state, and those new users who will finally get access to the high speed will especially need such protection. When cable and phone companies are left to their own devices, history shows they will violate these basic laws. As early as 2007, AT&T blocked iPhone users from using the app Skype so that they could make phone calls instead of using Skype, which basically AT&T was cut out. In 2005, a Canadian company blocked users who were trying to organize a labor strike, and so on and so on. You can look up these multiple laws where these large companies who hold all the chips can basically cut off anybody, and it's anti-competitive. especially us in Alaska, we're not a very big state, and none of those big corporations lie within our state. Even GCI is owned by a company outside of Alaska. So we need to take measures in our own state to protect our own citizens. Net neutrality protects, is a measurement that protects big corporations from small corporations, and so on. It's big from the small. Otherwise, history shows if they're left to their own devices, they'll do whatever they can to get one up on each other. Well, that's all I have to say.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Stepton. Are there any questions from the committee? I don't see any, so thanks for coming in. And our last person is Leon James, calling from Anchorage. If you put yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Leon Hymas. I live in Anchorage, and I was calling today to testify in support of net neutrality and in support of House Bill 277. I've been in the IT field for about 20 years now, and I currently work as an information security consultant. Net neutrality is vital to protecting Alaska's ability to realize independence from oil-based economy and to protecting the ability for telemedicine to continue expansion across the state without it being subjected to throttling or pay-to-play provisions. Without net neutrality regulations, free speech and privacy are also at risk. Net neutrality is vital to ensuring the Internet service providers are not able to engage and collection of large sets of data that are directly attributable to individuals. We have just witnessed a staggering and unprecedented abuse of information collection by Cambridge Analytica and Facebook, and we cannot allow our Internet service providers to become collectors of this same information. The way that the information is collected with net neutrality, or if it were to be implemented, would allow for granular collection of data that I would kind of liken to if you were going to drive down the freeway in order to get on the toll road, you would have to stop and have your car subject to search. And then, you know, based on the contents of your car and where you were going and who you were traveling with, you would be able to proceed on the fast lane. And there would be a record of the contents of your car, where you were going and who you were traveling with. It would be recorded, and that would be how it would be tied to your payment. So I'm very concerned about that. I think right now the information security is a top concern for a lot of people in countries and state and local organizations, and that most businesses are really challenged to protect that information. And I don't think that this would be any different, and it would be more data that would be available for theft. I had some other things that I was going to say, but that's my main concern. So with those considerations in mind, I support this bill, and I support implementing net neutrality for the state of Alaska. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Hymas. Does the committee have any questions? I don't see any questions. Is there anybody else here in the room or online who would like to testify? Seeing none, public testimony for HB 277 is now closed. We do have two people from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, RCA. Just wanted to give them an opportunity to say something if they had anything. It's Kristen Schubert or David Parrish, if you are there and you'd like to chime in, feel free to just put yourself on the record.
Sure. This is David Parrish with the RCA Common Carrier Section. I think I don't know that we have any additional comments to make now. We did issue a fiscal note that at least would summarize the impacts or the things that the commission would have to do if this bill became law. At this point in time, we aren't exactly sure what regulations would need to put in place in order to effectuate our responsibilities under the act, I think it's been brought up in other testimony that you know there is some it's a kind of an open question on whether or not this is an action that is not preempted by federal, by the FCC. I think it's an open question. I don't know that we can comment on that portion of it. But other than that, I don't know that we have a whole lot else to say unless there's questions.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Parrish. Does the committee have any questions? I don't see any questions. Thank you for – oh, we do have a question. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Parrish or somebody in your seat, the FCC has taken control of some of this issue. But what authority does the state have within itself to control what the state does?
I think that's actually an interesting avenue that that the state could look into. Obviously, there are state contracts. Other states, I think New York and Montana, have through executive actions taken some steps to basically ensure that any state contract for broadband services, any providers that want to compete for those contracts would have to adhere to certain to these types of net neutrality commitments. I think you could ostensibly use rights of way in order for a utility to gain access to right of way. Did have to make those kind of commitments. So I think there are other avenues that the state could take that would not implicate federal preemption so strongly, I guess, for lack of a better word. But I think if that answers your question.
Yes, I think it gets me pretty close. And I think it was another question. I think Representative, maybe not.
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg. Representative Kawasaki?
No, okay, I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for being online today. I did have a question, and just to make sure that it's on the record, basically this bill would say that that there would be prohibition on blocking, throttling, and paid and affiliate prioritization or interference. The one thing, there is another part of the bill that deals specifically with the Regulatory Commission, and it had to deal with an issue of things like telehealth and telemedicine, that those might be in the best public, would benefit the public interest. It's an item C of the bill. Can you speak to how the RCA would interpret that?
I'm assuming you're referring to, this is subsection C, perhaps, where we may waive the prohibition in B3. I would imagine then for those types of services that obviously have a public interest in aspect, that if there were other, I guess, through the network management of a particular carrier, if they felt that in order to make those services work appropriately, that they had to possibly throttle other or speed up or slow down other aspects of broadband internet access, for just regular residential use, it would allow carriers to make appropriate network management decisions. I think that's the way that we would see it, and that we would have the commission would have the ability to waive the prohibitions in the act when they found that the public interest was benefited.
And thank you. And so just to clarify, for things like if it has to do with health or education and public safety, those would be of particular public interest versus, say, the kid that plays a lot of games on the Internet. And that's how you would view it, that there's a public safety mission, there's a health and safety mission, there's an education mission that could supersede the other things. Is that correct?
Correct, and it would give carriers the ability to make those decisions without running afoul of the prohibition that's implicated by the act. So, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So what kind of complaints do you have that would kind of fall underneath net neutrality?
I'm sorry. I don't understand the question. Perhaps you could state that again.
Well, it sounds like in the fiscal note that it shows that there's 450 consumer complaints per year and that this bill could cause possibly 60 to 85 more complaints. What type of complaints do you see happening?
Oh, well, I know that I'm taking a look at our fiscal note. I don't know that that is.
Sorry, it's probably the Department of Law.
Okay, sorry.
Oops, sorry, I was looking at both of them. It was a good try, though. Well, it's somebody from the Department of Law that's still.
I see there's the attorney for Civil Division. I don't know if that's with the.
Yeah, it would be Civil Division, right?
Mr. Jonathan Clement, if you're there, if you could put yourself on the record and we can restate the question.
Yes, Chair Seaton, this is Jonathan Clement from the Department of Law.
And Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in your fiscal note, it says currently you have an average of 450 consumer complaints, and this bill could possibly add 60 to 85 more complaints. What type of complaints are you anticipating?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we did not try to make a determination of what kind of complaints might come in, but just broadly would be regarding net neutrality, and we anticipated, as the fiscal note states, that there might be additional complaints received in the future because of media coverage of this bill if it became law. So we were just sort of trying to estimate, the impact it might have on our work going forward if this bill became law.
Thank you.
Do we have any further questions? Okay, seeing none, we're going to go ahead and set the bill aside. And let's go ahead and set a amendments deadline to Jane Pearson in my office by 5 p.m. on Friday, April 6th. And so at our next meeting, scheduled for tomorrow, Thursday, April 5th at 1:30, we will do confirmations for the Mental Health Trust Authority Board and then two bills, HB 219, Criminal History Check, State Employee Contractors, and HB 240, which is the Pharmacy Benefits Managers. And is there anything else to come for the committee? Seeing none, we'll be adjourned here at 3:21 p.m. Thank you.